You could say Ferguson Inc.'s big industries are gravy trains and bandwagons, because that's how it's been here.
Ferguson Inc., it's a construct created by the struggles in a real-life city. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Senate Republicans took brash action to disrupt nuclear negotiations with Iran, and yet there's much they share with their foes.
For a long time, there has been a symbiotic relationship between the hardliners in Iran and the hardliners we have here in the United States.
Also, when the news is filled with chaos and confusion, it can really get to you. Radiolab host Jad Abumrad and I talk about nihilism today and throughout time.
There's a nowness to this particular flavor of it, because if you just turn on the news, you will see an endless stream of misery, greater than anything I've ever experienced in my childhood.
It's all coming up. Stay with us. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Early Thursday morning in Ferguson, an unknown gunman shot two police officers. They were released from the hospital later that morning. Charles Cook noted in the National Review Online that, quote, "They were not shot by Barack Obama, they were not shot by Eric Holder, and they were not shot by the media or the Democratic Party. Rather," he wrote, "a man who is in possession of his own agency made a terrible, disastrous decision. And anyone who would try to lay blame elsewhere should know better." Fox News predictably blamed Holder and Obama, and especially last week's Justice Department report that found endemic racism in the Ferguson police and city administration.
The president 6 days ago called that evidence that Ferguson Police Department was oppressive and abusive. And that is the environment in which this has happened.
Since the report's release, the police chief, the city manager, a judge, and two other police officers have resigned. But the situation remains tense and unresolved. The shooting occurred at the police station during one of many protests. The attack on the police was condemned by Holder and the president, and even by the family of Michael Brown, whose shooting death by a policeman last August turned Ferguson into a hashtag, a shorthand for activism, and also for chaos. Sarah Kendzior recently wrote a piece in Politico called Ferguson Inc., about an entity altogether different from the city it's named for.
Ferguson Inc. is something that is present in NGOs or in any kind of body that drops the Ferguson name in order to raise money. You also see politicians using it opportunistically in speeches, and especially when the media converges upon the city trying to cash in. And, you know, it almost feels like they're staging a Hunger Games. You know, you could say Ferguson Inc.'s big industries are gravy trains and bandwagons. There's a lot of talk about money on the streets of St. Louis. And I stress talk because there's not necessarily a lot of actual money in play. The average Ferguson protester is often struggling to get by.
You wrote that Ferguson Inc. is a trademark. It's a buzzword. It's something on a t-shirt. And it is basically seen as the place where it all began.
Yeah, and I think that that's a very unfortunate thing. Ferguson, after the grand jury verdict, became a point of departure for a lot of activists, and the money left with them. This movement began with a lot of people who were living in poverty, taking to the streets and raising issues not just about police violence, but about economic deprivation and about loss of opportunity and discrimination. And a lot of those people who were living in poverty on August 9th are still living in poverty, some more so because they gave up hourly wages and other things to become part of the protest movement.
You quote an activist, Charles Wade, saying that the media look to Twitter, but this is a story about people who aren't even on Twitter. So what's the story we're missing?
The story you're missing is the story of people who can't even afford a phone plan, much less go on and tweet prolifically. And that's a story that gets neglected. You know, people come here when, you know, like last night, there's officers that are shot, or when there's arson, or when there's looting, or when there's some sort of drama. But the real crisis is the sort of hardship of day-to-day living.
I did see one strong note of progress, I thought. The Missouri Supreme Court assigned a state appeals court judge on Monday to oversee all of the city's cases. They didn't just fire a judge, they've fired the local courts.
Yes, I definitely see that as a sign of progress. But, you know, there are 89 other municipalities in St. Louis County. So I think focusing on Ferguson as its own entity is the wrong way to look at things. You need to look at the places that honestly make Ferguson seem fair and functional by comparison. Ferguson is not the worst place to live in St. Louis County. It's not the place where you're most likely to be mistreated. It's just the most famous place.
So do you wish there weren't a Ferguson Inc.?
I do think it's better to have attention on what's happening in Ferguson than to not have attention at all. I wish that there was more attention to the plight of the everyday person in Ferguson, and that includes the everyday protester in Ferguson.
But Sarah, as you noted in your own piece, the constant protests, nobody sees them. Sometimes there are only a dozen people doing a memorial somewhere. I mean, is that worth the trouble?
Well, I think it depends on who your intended audience is. And I think some of the protest action is aimed at people locally. That's where power lies. The DOJ managed somehow to prompt these resignations. But I think until you see a change of who is in charge of various jurisdictions and who are our representatives, then you're not necessarily going to see actual change. I don't think that national media coverage is necessarily a great standard to judge the pragmatics of political movements.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Kendzior covers politics, economy, and the media. She's based in St. Louis. This week's Political Punch and Judy show comes courtesy of freshman Senator Tom Cotton, an open letter to the Iranian leadership signed by 47 Republican senators offering a lesson on American democracy and warning them to reject President Obama's deal on nuclear power. The letter was roundly condemned in the media, even by outlets that oppose the deal. Fox's Megyn Kelly.
But what's the point in writing to the Iranian mullahs? I mean, what are you going to do? They dismissed it already, whatever. And you've offended the Obama administration, and you may have offended some of the Democrats who would have come over with the Republicans, if depending on what happens with this deal, to have a stronger say in the Senate.
There were brief rumblings of illegality, even treason. Some, like John McCain, conceded he may have signed a little hastily. Anonymous Republican aides said the letter was intended to be cheeky. Then the defensive strategy changed to claiming moral equivalency. The letter, one senator declared, was the same as Nancy Pelosi's meeting some years back with Syria's Bashar al-Assad, although three Republican congressmen had made that trip before her and she was accompanied by State Department officials. Then the letter signers changed tack again and dug in. They sent it and they meant it. As the world clucked, the U.S. media duly chronicled the bathos. But according to Jamal Abdi, policy director for the National Iranian American Council, the impact could extend far beyond mere political theater.
Any sort of negotiation, if you're negotiating for a home loan or you're trying to buy a car, this is the phase where we're now, going over the fine print. And Congress has effectively come in and given the United States a bad credit report. We may not be able to honor our side of the deal. And so what that does is it has the potential of driving that cost up.
Love that analogy.
Yeah.
So do you think that Americans have gotten an accurate sense of what's gone on and what the potential impact is from our own media?
There has been a lack of clarity on whether these negotiations are the right thing or the wrong thing. This is the entry point for a lot of media consumers of what is happening at these negotiations. There has been this tendency to treat this letter more as this superficial political stunt, but not recognizing the real implications it's going to have for this very important, national security and foreign policy issue.
And the Iranian foreign minister also offered a bit of snark of his own back at Tom Cotton, did he not? And that's been covered in the press?
Yeah. So Tom Cotton had the letter translated into Persian. He tweeted it at Zarif and he said, in case you missed it, my letter to your country translated for you. Zarif was educated in the United States. He has a PhD in international law. He knows the American system very well. and responded shortly after with a, in case you missed it, my response in English.
Now, you've noted that there are some marked similarities between some precincts of the American media and that of the Iranian press.
Well, for a long time, there has been a symbiotic relationship between the hardliners in Iran and the hardliners we have here in the United States. So anytime Ahmadinejad was saying some horrible thing, that was used in the U.S. press and by Fox News and some of the more conservative outlets. And even to this day, groups like United Against Nuclear Iran or the pro-Israel groups like AIPAC are still using Ahmadinejad quotes. And the guy's not even the president anymore. He's completely marginalized and does not have a lot of political power in Iran.
And so this symbiotic relationship you're talking about, tell me how it plays out in the hardline Iranian press.
For instance, you know, recently there was the Benjamin Netanyahu address to Congress. When Netanyahu came and made his speech, Rafsanjani, the former president of Iran, the moderate political figure, he accused the hardliners of having the same positions as Netanyahu. He said, this is a bad deal, we shouldn't sign it. The hardest line of the hardline outlets, Kayhan, defended themselves, and they ran one of their typical sort of blustery editorials. And they said, no, Netanyahu's speech was a ploy. He actually supports the deal.
Some Republicans do seem to be trying to walk it back.
Now that it's been processed in the media and there's been such a harsh backlash from the White House and there's been something like 50 editorials against the letter, a lot of Republicans have not necessarily been defending it. That being said, you're starting to see them pivot a little bit. And they're saying, okay, this was maybe not good diplomacy, but what the letter said is accurate. A lot of folks who sign on to this letter do think that there is sort of a second life for this thing and that they will be vindicated in the end if they carry it out a few steps further.
So you don't think then that this could be the moment when legislators learn to count to 10 before indulging in such stunts?
As far as Tom Cotton is concerned, look at all the media coverage he's gotten for this. I mean, he's now a superstar. You know, it reminds me of the episode a couple of years ago during the State of the Union with the House Republican who shouted, "You lie," at President Obama. And a lot of people thought, oh, this is an embarrassment. He needs to apologize. But he turned around and had a record-breaking fundraiser the next day. I don't know that Tom Cotton is really licking his wounds. He's probably out there raising more money.
Jamal, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Jamal Abdi is the policy director for the National Iranian American Council in Washington, D.C. Coming up, Staring into the Abyss with Radiolab's Jad Abumrad. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Meredith from TLDR. This week we tackle a big question. Is magic real?
Aha! Something happened.
Magic is real.
Magic is real.
Magic is real. I mean, just for our listeners.
Yeah, duh. That's
totally real. Be sure to listen. And if you like the show, subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and give us a review. Thanks.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Numbed by the absurdity of our democracy in action, we'll now spend the rest of the show visiting two stories that wrangle over the nature of nihilism, one from Radiolab's Jad Abumrad and the other by me. Our argument played out last summer Then the news was especially grim. Ebola was raging in West Africa, and beheadings were still a hideous novelty. And then in the midst of all of that, something weird happened to Jad's brother-in-law.
I'm Eugene Thacker. I'm an author and professor at the New School in New York City.
Jad asked me to join him and Eugene to talk about what happened.
Eugene is a hardcore scholar of philosophy, and he writes these books that sometimes can be a little dense. I mean, he'll use words like exegesis and ratiocination. And so the family joke is that he writes books for no one.
I think the joke started out, I write books that nobody reads. And then after a slow, long period of acceptance, I started to think, well, maybe I should write books for no one to read and just sort of embrace that.
So the story begins a couple years ago.
In 2011.
Eugene writes this book.
Called In the Dust of This Planet. It's about the end of the world.
But not in the Hollywood sense. It's darker than that.
Your hypothesis is the greatest horror is that nothing exists and nothing matters.
Right. What in philosophy is often referred to as nihilism or pessimism, that there might not be a purpose to things or to your life or to our existence or to the cosmos, and this all might be purely arbitrary and an accident.
That there's no inherent meaning to anything.
That it just doesn't matter.
This is what Nietzsche called
the most difficult thought.
And in the book, Eugene traces this idea through all of these different horror movies, from slasher films to sort of more supernatural horror. And also music. I mean, at one point, he goes into this deconstruction of how different types of black metal deal with this thought.
I don't know. It's a way of thinking I've always found really intriguing and ironically kind of inspiring.
Are you a pessimist?
On my better days.
Are you a nihilist?
Not as much as I should be.
Okay, so Eugene writes this book in 2011. It is dark. It is dense. He writes it, as he says, for no one. And as expected, beyond a few philosophy types, no one really pays attention. So he keeps his head down, teaching, writing. But then, some things happen. 2014.
No kinds of ghettos in the world.
It's all one ghetto, man. Giant gutter in outer space.
The show True Detective comes along. Comes a big hit. And at the center of the show is this character, Russ Cole, this Louisiana detective, who is one dark dude.
I think human consciousness is a tragic misstep in evolution.
He goes on these rants about how there's no order in the world, how humans are just this accident, and we have to deal with that.
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right? But in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
And I just remember watching it and being like, wow.
That's Eugene's wife, Prema Murthy, my sister-in-law.
I was like, this replicates so many conversations that we've had in the car.
She's like, were they listening in on us?
Yeah, it was eerie.
So Prema goes online, clicks around.
And all of a sudden I see this article about the True Detective director.
It was an article where actually the writer of the show, Nick Pizzolatto, was asked, how did you create that character of the nihilist police detective? And he lists a bunch of things he was reading at the time.
And included in that list was Eugene.
To which I was like, cool. At least one person is reading the book.
But I really just try to tee my head to the ground and just keep writing, just doing what I'm doing.
But then, things got weirder.
Okay, so now let's pull up the Lucky magazine. Let's see if we can find it.
Short time later, Prema is flipping through this fashion magazine.
Lucky magazine, and there was a spread with this actress.
Lily Collins, 25-year-old actress.
Who I'd never heard of.
Pretty big right now. She's standing on a street corner.
Dressed up in all of this sort of goth makeup and clothing.
And in the photo, she is wearing Eugene's book on her chest.
She had on, in one of the shots, a sweatshirt that had the cover of the book.
In the Dust of This Planet. Big letters right on her chest.
And I was just like, no way.
I mean, it was definitely, what the f***?
This is crazy. Yeah. Like, what? She's just casually wearing my husband's book cover.
I don't know. Again, I didn't react to, but it was just strange.
Turns out a Norwegian artist had made a painting of the book. That image had gotten picked up by a fashion label and turned into some very expensive clothes. Okay, so that happened. But then it gets weirder still. So one day my wife, Carla Murthy, is online. This is the day that Jay-Z and Beyonce announced they're going to do this big international tour. Carla's watching the video that they released to promote that tour, sort of a fake movie trailer.
It says On the Run, it's all flashy, guns, fire, hookers.
Beyonce's in a wedding dress.
She's got a veil on.
But she's shooting semi-automatic weapons in a wedding dress, cut to car chases, cut to money flying everywhere. But at exactly 37 seconds in...
Go back. It's like you're making me think too fast.
You see Jay-Z turn, stick a giant gun out to his right, and he is wearing Eugene's book. Right there on his back, in the dust of this planet. Now, this is the point at which I was like, okay, what do we make of this? I mean, could it be that Eugene is no longer writing books for no one, that somehow he has become a conduit for this idea that we all, in that subterranean way that pop music operates, that we all are channeling right now? That was my thought.
Yeah, no, I think that's the question, is whether this is something particular to the moment we're living in.
And Eugene... his knee-jerk reaction is...
I think it could have been this cover or a million other covers.
No. This is just meaningless appropriation.
I don't think there's anything more than that to me than it's just, it looks like a cool phrase to go on a t-shirt to put on a goth girl in some photo shoot.
And why is it cool?
Right. Because my hunch is you might be right, but you also might be wrong because of the answer that you're about to give to Brooke's question.
It's cool because some publicist...
No.
I mean, this was sort of the conversation I wanted to have, and it's why I called Brooke. Like, what is behind all of this nihilistic entertainment that's everywhere? Now, Brooke, for her part, agreed that Eugene probably is tapping into something.
Yes, but is this unique to this moment? And to that, I would say no.
Really? You don't think this says anything about now?
I think there are cycles in which the sense of meaninglessness comes out in sharper relief than other times.
Mm.
But you can identify them over and over again.
Yeah. Nihilism goes all the way back.
Brooke actually turned us on to this guy.
Simon Critchley. I am the Hans Jonas Professor at the New School for Social Research.
Simon wrote an article that basically made the argument that nihilism is the basic credo of cool.
Because it's sexy, it's interesting,
and it's been that way forever.
Oh, I've got the best thing for you. You'll love this. It's a Russian word, right?
He said the word really got its pop in 1862. This is 150 years ago.
There's a novel by Turgenev called Fathers and Sons.
And in the novel, the son, who's the nihilist, turns to his conservative dad. And he says,
we base our conduct on what we recognize as useful. In these days, the most useful thing we can do is to repudiate. And so we repudiate everything. The father says, everything? Everything. With indescribable composure. So that's the nihilist moment. Everything goes.
And Simon says, roughly from that point on, you see young people glom on to this idea again and again as a way to... you know, say no to the older generation or to just what's happening in the world.
Pop culture, at least since I was a kid, has always been deeply nihilistic, you know.
All right, so it's nothing new. But when I ran Simon through the Eugene jacket situation, and then I asked him, like, is there something different about today's nihilism versus nihilisms of the past? Like, is there something more potent about it? Without hesitation, he said...
I'd say yes, mm-hmm.
Huh.
Based on what?
That's producer Andy Mills, who was with me during the interview.
Well...
Simon says it was more of a gut feeling based on this class that he taught last year with Eugene, oddly enough. I didn't actually know that they knew each other, but they had taught this class together.
So the seminar that we did in the fall last year was one of those rare seminars. We're teaching mysticism. Nobody teaches mysticism.
He says they started the seminar not really expecting much, by talking about how in the 4th century AD...
there was a city, Alexandria.
This is near Egypt.
Right? Alexandria was a lot like Manhattan. It was an offshore island. And it's the seat of all culture and all learning in the ancient world. At a certain point in the 4th century, people start to leave. people wander off and they seem to want something else. The city doesn't do it anymore.
Why?
It's corrupt. It's broken. It's sinful.
He said crime was rampant, pollution, and so people just started to wander off into the desert and live in these caves.
And these intense forms of ascetic practice begin.
Like you had these women who were so enraptured with Christ that they began
hurting themselves, throwing themselves into icy rivers, jumping into ovens. The body is something which is you're trying to strip away in order that you can free the capacity for love. But the premise of that, again, is that the world is a kind of field of ruins.
But he says what really struck him is that as he was talking about all this, he would glance out at the students and he would notice this look in their eyes.
I just felt that in the room there was this deep need was being fulfilled by these strange mystics.
What exactly? I mean, do you think they were starting to form the thought of wandering into the desert, so to speak?
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which you know, what do you do? Secede, walk away. You know, that's where a lot of people are at.
As for what's behind it all, he says, just turn on the news.
A video showing the beheading of a second American journalist has now been verified.
Disease experts say this is turning into one of the longest, deadliest outbreaks ever.
The girls were gang raped and strangled.
Once again, it is mostly children we are seeing brought into this hospital.
I mean, the world I grew up in made sense. It was completely crazy, mutually assured destruction, but it made sense. And you could understand it in very simple terms. There was the United States, there was the Soviet Union. We were going to be eviscerated. That was clear. But, you knew what the balance of power was.
You're nostalgic for mutually assured destruction? Is that what's happening now?
It seems a much simpler world.
You at least knew who to blame for it, right?
Right.
That's Andy again.
And now?
Yeah.
Who am I supposed to say f*** you to? I'm saying f*** you to...
Everybody.
Carbon emissions!
Speaking of which...
Today, the world's leading climate scientists warn it will get worse.
No doubt, one of the reasons for the current gloom is that we are in the middle of an uncomfortable shift in how we talk about climate change.
Heat waves will be more frequent and last longer.
This was made official when the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released a report where, for the first time, they stopped using the language of prevention and shifted to the language of adaptation. In other words, hundreds of scientists and policymakers, this is the world's top organization for assessing climate change, we're now saying, we can't stop it. It's inevitable.
So now we need to talk about dealing with the mess that is now on our doorstep.
That's David Victor,
professor of international relations at University of California at San Diego.
And he is one of the authors of the report.
When the IPCC first began back in the late 1980s, you could imagine that people would take the climate change problem seriously. They would start to control emissions. And then over a period of decades, climate would stop changing. And instead, what's happened is people have talked a lot about climate change, but they haven't actually done much to control emissions. You know, the report says, if you put into place all these technologies and international agreements, we could still stop warming at 2 degrees. My own assessment is that the kinds of actions you'd need to do that are so heroic that we're not going to see them on this planet.
All of which reminded me of that True Detective moment.
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right? But in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
Okay, what's that mean?
Well, pessimists like nihilists agree there's no meaning. They're just a little more mopey about it, less likely to do something.
Means I'm bad at parties.
I mean, is that where we're all headed? You know, in a recent Wall Street Journal poll, 76% of people 18 and over weren't confident that the future is going to be brighter than the past. Which brings me back to Brooke's question.
Why is it cool?
Call it nihilism, pessimism, whatever. Shouldn't it be depressing? Why would you want to put a phrase like in the dust of this planet? A phrase that deliberately negates the person wearing it. Why would you want to put it on your chest or on your back?
Yeah, we do.
And since it was Jay-Z's jacket, which was in a way the catalyst for this whole podcast, we ended up in the flow of things.
Like, they want to talk to me? Why?
That's a good question.
Talking to this lady, who it turns out was the person who made the decision to put it on Jay-Z's back.
I should say my name, I guess. My name is June Ambrose. I've been a costume designer for 22 years, 23 this year, and I've worked with everyone from Luther Vandross to Puffy to Sean to Mariah Carey, Busta Rhymes, Mary J. Blige, Alicia Keys, Dave Matthews Band, Backstreet Boys, Kelly Ripa, Kim Cattrall,
do this, but,
R. Kelly,
go ahead on, bring them off with a little...
Jamie Foxx, Missy Elliott,
and of course, Jay-Z and Beyonce. It occurred to Andy and I during the interview that June has probably influenced the fashion sense of a significant portion of the human beings on this planet. And she was very clear that a costume is more than just a costume.
It's like a conversation without words.
That really what she's doing when she styles someone is whispering to all the people that are going to watch the videos, come in contact with the billboards, go to the concerts.
Like, I don't have to talk to you, but I can create this conversation with a pair of pants and how they fall and how they fit and the texture and the color and the feel.
She says with Jay-Z for that video, she knew she needed something epic.
But like effortless. I knew I wanted a biker jacket because it was a motorcycle scene, but I knew that I just couldn't give him a black leather. I needed to say something. So we were on the hunt.
Her and her assistant went to dozens of places.
Ateliers, studios, the showrooms.
Looking at all these leather jackets.
It's like finding a needle in a haystack.
Nothing was right.
But then...
they saunter into this one place.
Black denim.
This place that does sort of high-end grunge. They're flipping through the racks when... she sees it. The jacket. Those words.
And that was it. I knew it. I said, this is what I need. It just felt... I mean, it was just perfect.
Question was why. At this point, I hadn't really told her the whole backstory. So I pulled out a screen capture from the video. This is one where you see Jay-Z sort of standing in the desert, shot from behind, in the dust of this planet on his back. And he's kind of pointing this really long, dirty, hairy gun off to his right, sort of up, like he's about to shoot the sun.
Yeah, you think he's about to shoot the sun.
Okay, so let's just look at this for a second.
Yeah.
So, like, why did you choose that jacket?
You know, it's something very menacing about it. It's almost like the aftermath. The end of an era, the beginning of something new.
She says in the back of her head she was thinking about how the music industry might be dying.
It's definitely in a place where it's like, what now? You can hear it in the music.
And, you know, if this is the biggest tour in history, really, what now?
You know, and these are the whispers that you hear.
But she says one of the loudest whispers was super simple. Just, here's a guy. Massive pop star.
Like a sovereign.
He's in the desert. It's about to go down. The end of the world is literally on his back.
But it was almost as if he didn't even know that was on his back. You know what I mean? It's like, that was the afterthought.
Like, oh yeah, the world's ending? Psst, I don't care.
Going out and stuff.
In other words?
He wasn't afraid.
He wasn't afraid.
Wasn't afraid.
You know what? That's what this... we talk about whispers. That's what I get from it. Now that you said that. It's not so much I don't give a shit, I'm not afraid.
Yeah. I mean, we all have to leave the planet. You know, everybody has their day. What you work on is not being afraid when you have to leave.
I think that is nothing more than a posture. I mean, it's all fine when you're 18 to wear that t-shirt, but when you're like in your 50s dealing with cancer, like, okay, you know, maybe then is when you really have to confront those things. So it's simply a posture, and that's why it's in pop culture.
A quite cynical response would be to say, you know, why we love nihilism in pop culture is that it saves us having to be burdened with it.
Simon Critchley again.
It saves us from feeling it, right? We can enjoy it in our rooms. We can get off on it, and then we let it go. And we go back to work.
But Simon says, you don't have to be cynical about this if you don't want to be. I mean... Nietzsche, Mr. Dark Pessimist himself, had this idea about nihilism that it was just the beginning. That if you really dealt with it, took it in, accelerated it to its logical end, you could get to the other side. Which he called...
a reevaluation of values. Some new way of thinking about who we are as moral creatures. And that's kind of where I am. And love. Love is that capacity which can see through that.
And that, he suspects, is why his students were so interested in those mystics, because they had found a way through.
These people, these mystics, have got the uncompromising commitment to something like love.
The fact that they were ready to go all the way, to negate even their own bodies for that love.
Right, so in a world where love has been reduced to Tinder exchanges, if that's the hell that you're living in as a 25-year-old, then, yeah, you're going to read these mystics and think, I want what she's having, you know. I'll take what she's having.
Burn my flesh.
That's right, burn my flesh.
And you could argue, I mean, why not, that Jay-Z and Beyoncé, they've got a little bit of that going on. I mean, part of what's made this tour so big, biggest tour ever, actually, is that it's like this grand love story.
I'm with the love of my life, so it's right. All, it's like, it works.
Well, but you'd say, but
I have a fantasy. Good. I have a fantasy that Beyoncé and Jay-Z will do this tour, and they will go off into the desert, and they'll live in a little hut, like this monastic existence. A new sort of Age of Aquarius will begin, starting with the two of them.
That's beautiful.
Any chance of that?
Pina colada on the beach.
Maybe a perfect response to Jade's question.
Yeah.
Coming up, I present my theory to Chad about why his theory is wrong. This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This seems to be as good a time as any for a quick taxonomy of nihilism. There's existential nihilism, the belief that life is meaningless. Political nihilism, the belief that political systems are pointless and should be overthrown. Then there's ethical and moral nihilism. You probably work that one out. And epistemological nihilism, the belief that you can know nothing. And finally, ontological nihilism, the belief that nothing is real, so there's nothing to know. In The Matrix, Agent Smith embodies them all.
You believe you're fighting for something, for more than your survival? Can you tell me what it is? Do you even know? Is it freedom or truth? Perhaps peace? Could it be for love? Illusions, Mr. Anderson, vagaries of perception. Temporary constructs of a feeble human intellect trying desperately to justify an existence that is without meaning or purpose. And all
of them is artificial. The moral nihilist finds its fullest expression in Rorschach, a killer of killers in the comic book series Watchmen. This installment of his story is called The Abyss Gazes Also. That's a nod to Nietzsche's warning to beware that when fighting monsters, you yourself do not become a monster, for when you gaze long into the abyss gazes also into you.
Streets stank of fire. The void breathed hard on my heart, turning its illusions to ice, shattering them. Was reborn then, free to scrawl own design on this morally blank world. Was Rorschach. Does that answer your questions, Doctor?
That was in the 80s. The 70s, what with the Vietnam War, Watergate, a listless economy, rampant crime, and streets steeped in the sour funk left by the spoiled ardor of the 60s, was a prime decade for nihilism. And punk was its medium. Iggy Pop, Sid Vicious, Johnny Rotten, Richard Hell, and the Voidoids.
I belong to the blank generation, and I can take it or leave it each time.
Now that was a far cry from the ecstatic nihilism of the late 50s and early 60s, which was a rebuke to the stifling conformity of the Eisenhower era and a finger flung at the likely prospect of nuclear annihilation. In 1959, Allen Ginsberg said that America was having a nervous breakdown, inciting exaltation, despair, prophecy, strain, suicide, and public gaiety among the poets. He published Howl in 1956.
visions, omens, hallucinations, miracles, ecstasies, gone down the American River, dreams, adorations, illuminations, religions, the whole boatload of sensitive bullshit.
Moving further back into the post-war era, existentialism, which is pretty much existential nihilism, flowers. The word was coined in France, but the idea begins with early 19th century philosopher Soren Kierkegaard, who argued that each individual is responsible for giving his or her life meaning. The French variant was advanced by Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, and Albert Camus amid the disgrace of the intellectual establishment. The climate of cynicism and despair also gave rise to the theater of the absurd. Sartre wasn't an absurdist, but he did write fiction, like Nausea.
Here we all are, all of us, eating and drinking to preserve our precious existence. And there's nothing. Nothing, absolutely no reason for existing.
But for me, the nihilist movement Nonpareil was the one that sprang to life in a Zurich nightclub called Café Voltaire after the First World War, which makes sense because of the unmatched enormity and pointlessness of that war. Nihilism thrived in every sphere and spawned a kind of performance art philosophy called Dada. One of its founders, Tristan Tzara, recommended cutting up a newspaper article into words and phrases, throwing them into a bag, and then randomly reassembling them into poetry. He said Dada did not signify in art, but a disgust with the, quote, magnificence of philosophers. What good did their theories do us, he asked. We are, we argue, we dispute, we get excited. All the rest is sauce.
You don't think this says anything about now?
Now, Chad was really resistant to the idea that today's tendency towards nihilism is pretty much the same as all the others, at least in its general contours. If that. I mean, these days a movement is co-opted before it even gets off the ground. I argued that if, as some suggest, faith is part of our wiring, so is nihilism. Actually, maybe I was a little over-emphatic. Didn't you go through a period when you didn't think anything was real? When I was like 8, I would look at everything around me and think it was just a backdrop. Take my hand sometimes and I would drag it along the sidewalk till I made it bleed.
Really?
To see if it felt more real.
Huh.
I think at some point any intelligent person questions the truth of everything that's around them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The cultural argument I would make is that there's a nowness to this particular flavor of it because if you just turn on the news, you will see an endless stream of misery that is not just depressing, which it is. It's greater than anything I've ever experienced in my childhood.
I want to pull up here on the computer something that occurred after a time of enormous disorder after World War I, the manifesto of Tristan Tzara.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, everything one looks at is false. If I shout ideal, 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 knowledge, 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 boom, 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 I have given a pretty faithful version of progress law, morality, and all the other fine qualities that various highly intelligent men have discussed in so many books, only to conclude that after all, everyone dances to his own personal boom, boom, and that the writer is entitled to his boom, boom.
This is so great.
Dada. Abolition of logic, which is the dance of those impotent to create. Dada, abolition of memory. Dada, abolition of archaeology. Dada, abolition of prophets. Dada, abolition of the future.
That is incredible. It's so full of spirit and vigor that it almost contradicts its negation.
It is dropping the heavy, blood-soaked mantle of the war and the lies that were told to all the people who were sent in to fight that pointless war.
Mm.
All of the pictures of trench warfare were suppressed until after, and hence you had what was called the lost generation. A lost generation is ripe for nihilism, an active and positive embrace of what seems to be the only kind of truth, which is that there isn't one.
The cycle that we're in now, I mean, it doesn't feel positive in a way.
I get that. But Camus said that accepting the absurdity of everything around us is just one step. It should not become a dead end. It arouses a revolt that can become fruitful. Hey, did you know that Nietzsche wrote music? He wrote this. Apparently, the first time his good friend Richard Wagner heard one of his compositions, he ran out of the room screaming with laughter. Brutal. Okay, so where were we? We touched on Nietzsche, mentioned Kierkegaard. I'm going to skip over really important people like Heidegger and Schopenhauer, the Russian anarchist Bakunin, and the Russian novelist Turgenev, who popularized the word nihilism in his novel Fathers and Children. Now I'm looking for household names. Some say Hamlet was a nihilist because he called man a quintessence of dust. I think he was just depressed. But Shakespeare really knew how to build an existential nihilist when he wanted to.
Out. Out, brief candle.
Life is but a walking shadow.
A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage.
And then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot. It's full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
The hour, this meaningless hour, is drawing to its inevitable end, as are we all. So I'll rush back to the Greeks. Epicurus really fits my premise. He lived in a chaotic time, right after the death of Alexander the Great and during the subsequent collapse of Hellenism. He was, in a sense, the Alfred E. Newman. Epicureans sought to reach a state of being called ataraxia, that is, utterly free of care. The world was created by chance. The gods, if they exist, don't care about us. Love and politics are not worth the trouble. As for death, he said, accustom yourself to believe that death is nothing to us, for good and evil imply awareness, and death is the privation of all awareness. Therefore, a right understanding that death is nothing to us makes the mortality of life enjoyable, not by adding to life an unlimited time, but by taking away the yearning after immortality. In other words, forget about it. But if Dada is my favorite expression of nihilism, this last one is definitely runner-up. So I'm going to bring back Chad and Cher.
Go ahead. Eat your food and be happy. Drink your wine and be cheerful. It's all right with God. Always look happy and cheerful. Enjoy life with the one you love as long as you live the useless life that God has given you in this world. Enjoy every useless day of it because that is all you will get for all your trouble.
Who is that?
That's Ecclesiastes.
Oh, really? That's nihilism in a place I wouldn't have expected.
So I submit that as my quad erat demonstrandum.
Oh, is it your contention that this means nihilism is a sort of a like a hum that goes through all times and not anything specific to this time?
Right. We can't escape the fact of our own death.
Hmm. Am I supposed to say something now? Am I supposed to argue with you? I suddenly am persuaded. Whoever's talking, I just agree. Should I argue with you?
Sure.
It seems to me that we're all having those thoughts a little bit more, and our responses to those thoughts are different now than they ever have been. You can do any number of responses. You can decide to live a great life and have yoga and grow zucchini, or you can decide, F it, and, you know, just be a hedonist. But there is some way in which we're all responding in a way that just is like a kind of a shrug, like, forget it. It just seems to me, when I think about the ways in which people are thinking about climate change, I think about, it doesn't seem, maybe I'm just depressed, Brooke. Is that what I'm just saying to you?
You have two small kids. I just don't think you have enough sleep.
It could be.
I think a true nihilist has to have a lot of energy.
Yeah, that is true.
As I went through my exploration of it, you know, you have Camus who says that the best response is to rebel. Rebel against death. Create life on your own terms. Build it for yourself. Mm-hmm. And one way or another, we do. Sometimes we don't live a very conscious life, but we're living a life. I just think that this time, if anything, we have just grown vaguely uncomfortable in this world that seems so chaotic, but in our lives barely touches us. Essentially, we're taking in the world through the media. So it may feel more deadening, mm-hmm. but it's less intense. If you ever had to confront it because the conditions of your life have just crumbled to dust and your beliefs can no longer be sustained, I bet you'd have more energy for it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, I think I'm with you on that one. There's a sort of a seduction to the idea of nihilism because in one version of it, it can be an energetic, strong, well, it's like revolution. It's like saying no to something, and there's something very powerful and intoxicating about that. But then there's different kind of nihilism that just goes, eh. It's a sigh nihilism versus a rah nihilism. And I guess that in an ambient sense is the nihilism that I smell in the air.
I wonder if that's what you'd call it, though. I think what you're sensing is actually apathy.
Yeah, that's another word for it.
Well, that's cheerful.
You want to get a beer?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Kasia Mikhailovich, Andrew Chug, and Julia Hsu. We had more help from Jesse Brenneman, and our show was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was David Grinbaum. Katja Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. And hey, we have yet another new podcast for you. On House of Cards, a recap show. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Langston.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.